I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the podcast. Another sans Jamie episode because Jamie has had a second baby. Who'd have thought that one was possible? Now he's gone and have another and he's in baby bunker dealing with whatever that means. Helen O'Hara joins me. Helen from Empire Magazine and
hello.
And her own enterprises. It's been a long time, Helen.
Too long.
Yeah. The last time we spoke, I think it was in the last year and a half, but it feels like 3 weeks ago. It's funny how when you see people that you've not spoken to, I spoke to a friend who I've not spoken to, I think, for 20 years the other day. And it's totally true that you just carry on where you left off.
Yeah, I've had a similar friend who was Portuguese, came to our school, went right through school with us, and then had a baby quite soon after she graduated. And so we vaguely kept in touch sometimes on Facebook over the years, but not really. Yeah. And when we finally actually found ourselves in the same city, it was exactly like we'd never stopped talking.
Which is why I don't want to go to any school reunions ever. Because it's like, in your mind, you'll think, well, the people who picked on me, they'll have changed. They'll be more mature and they'll feel sorry for what they did. And they won't. They'll be exactly the same. You show up and the first thing they'll do is like give you a wedgie or whatever.
Oh, no. Come on.
I don't think I was ever given a wedgie, but
no.
Yeah, I would have preferred it, I think, to the mental abuse.
The mental torment.
Yeah, exactly. Helen and I have just been talking about the world and fake news, newspapers and all sorts. I think it's interesting talking to Helen because do we even want to get into any of this? I don't know if we do. Let's just say I'm struggling not to find the world depressing at the moment because people are people have been given... Trump did it better than anybody. And the method is this. If, let's say you are a thief, let's say you go and steal somebody's handbag, and then somebody walks around the corner and puts a camera in your face, before they can even ask you a question, what you need to do is accuse your enemy of being a thief.
Mm-hmm.
That's the method. It's what Trump does. So people who use the term fake news, more often than not, even if they know it or not, more often than not, they themselves are the liars. Mm-hmm. They themselves are the ones. And this is the trick that I've seen more and more, and it's massively distressing. It's no different from school bullies, right? Or it's no different of a kid. It's essentially a kid pointing at another kid.
Yeah.
Their mouth is covered in chocolate and they point at the other kid and say, "Mom, she ate the chocolate."
Mm-hmm. I think that, yeah, it is that level of childishness for sure. But with a certain degree of malignancy, because I think people who are of, you know, maybe let's say the sort of the classic uninformed voter that they talk about in the US, who, you know, hasn't been keeping up on the issues, doesn't obsessively follow this stuff, because we shouldn't have to. This is a thing that a lot of people said during the Trump era. You know, the reason that they're looking forward to Biden coming into power is not because they think he's amazing, not because they think he's going to fundamentally change the world for the better. He'll be better than Trump, but that's not a high bar. We all know that. They just want somebody to feel like somebody competent is there trying their best, so they can start ignoring politics, right? So all the people who have been ignoring politics are the sort of classic uninformed voters. Mm. And there is a number of those people who are, a sort of subsection, who are then vulnerable to this kind of disinformation tactic. Because, of course, there have been mistakes made on both sides of the political spectrum. So if somebody comes to you and says, they're all as bad as each other, maybe you are inclined to believe them. you know, and maybe you're inclined to give that credence because, quite frankly, it is credible that both sides make mistakes, 100% credible. But the problem is, the problem that arises and what we're seeing more and more in the real world is when one side, and it really is one side, completely abandons any attempt at good faith, completely abandons any attempt to rationally explain things, to do what is rationally
decency,
and completely abandons any attempt to apologize when things go horribly wrong. And that is genuinely what we're saying. And I, you know, I really am trying to sort of, you know, account for my own biases when I say this. I mean, I will absolutely be first in line to criticize Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. I think he was a terrible party leader. I don't think he's necessarily a terrible person, but I think he was a terrible, terrible leader of the opposition.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't call them on their, frankly, you know, nonsense.
Yeah.
I'm using polite words to try and be polite.
You can say but, what you want.
Okay, good. He wouldn't call them on their bullshit. Like 4 years of Brexit bullshit that they've just spouted unchallenged in this country. The same thing with the US. You know, we've got these Democrats who are worried about sort of decorum and still worried about this kind of both sidesism. And you know, the other side has abandoned all pretense at civility, has abandoned all pretense at equivalence.
Yeah.
So, you know, you see this in the arguments they made about the Supreme Court. So when a Supreme Court judge dies about 9 months before Obama leaves office, it's far too close to the end of his term for him to be allowed to nominate a successor, despite the fact that that's not a thing. That's not a rule.
Yeah.
But when a Supreme Court justice dies like 20 or so days before the election that kicked Trump out, he is entirely justified and indeed obligated to fill that seat. And there is, they know that that's a contradiction. They know that's hypocritical.
Yeah.
And the difference is they don't care at all.
No, but that's the issue. And there are two separate things here in terms of what the left needed to learn and what decency is anyway. Because when the gloves are off, if you take that metaphor, and that's what you're saying, is one side has taken the gloves off and said, it doesn't matter. Winning is the only thing.
It's the only thing that matters.
That matters. If you have an actual fight and somebody takes the gloves off, and both sides, you then invite the other side, they must take their gloves off. And either way,
and
the
fight
only ends in one way, which is a horrible, horrible, bloody mess.
And I get the whole they go low, we go high thing, and that's what I want to do. But at the same time, that only works if you are constantly getting out the message, not just saying, but actively communicating to people, having them listen to you when you say they are lying to you.
Yeah.
This is a lie. This is this is hypocrisy. And when those people then care about that enough for it to have consequences, because that's the problem. We're not seeing consequences. Now, the wider issue, and God, I don't know, I'm not a political journalist, but, you know, I read a lot about this. And so forgive me if I'm uninformed in some respects. But the wider issue, it seems to me, is this disengagement and disenchantment with politics and this universal cynicism. I have no place for kind of this nihilism that nothing matters, that nothing we do matters. I find it, I know I've talked about this a lot vis-a-vis films, I find it incredibly pointless. Even if it's true, it's pointless. Even if it's true, it makes your life worse. So why not try and believe literally anything else about the world? Believe that you have some modicum of power. Believe that what you do matters. Tell politicians that you care. Tell politicians that you see them taking money from oil companies and ignoring the environment. Tell them that. Write a letter. It might not matter individually, but if enough of us do it, it will start to matter. You know, and that's the kind of the both sidesism. There have been studies done which show that politicians don't actually listen to their constituents. The things that people say they care about in opinion polls, that doesn't affect what gets done. And majority of people now say they care about climate change. That's not enough. You know, we need to act like it, and we need to communicate to them that we are serious about this in the hope of having something change. Because at the moment, you know, we've got one side who are merrily watching the world burn to own the libs.
Yeah.
And I mean, they are a death cult. They will literally allow themselves and each other to die of COVID rather than wear a mask because, you know, they think that the people wearing the masks are liberals. I just, it's this mindless hatred is kind of all encompassing.
And yet humans are still beautiful people.
Mm. Yeah. And a lot of these people are, people who voted for these people are probably good, kind, decent humans to one another individually. But the problem is they're not considering the effect that that has on immigrants, on minorities, on gay people, on, you know, anyone who isn't their immediate circle.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Yeah, exactly, but they don't care about that. And I have got some truck with that because it's a traditional part of our ecosystem, if you like, is that you tend to have, you have issues. All voting happens based on how a policy can improve my life. That's how people vote. And that's why the left have gone so horribly wrong, is that they haven't, Corbyn absolutely failed to suggest a vision that most people can buy into and go, yes, I can get behind that. I get what this is about and I want those things. As part of our ecosystem traditionally, you know, my granddad was a farmer and therefore conservative. And if you live in the middle of a field, in the middle of nowhere, where the seasons affect how much you're able to feed your family, you want to pay as little tax that is relevant to people who live far away as possible. And the same is true of people who I've met in Nevada who are pro-gun and pro-Republican, but also are fundamentally really, really nice human beings, and that their belief is, look, my whole thing is we all live on ranches. We believe that our neighbors should be able to do anything they want. If it doesn't mess around with our land or whatever, they can do whatever they want on their land. And that's the respect that we've got. And that's a tradition that I can understand. And
I understand that intellectually. Yeah.
Yeah. Practically. I know that farm doesn't get to exist without the cities that it's also feeding, and therefore you have a social responsibility. But
just, you know, driving on roads and, you know, educating your children. And I mean, the problem is, of course, one of the things that the right wing has done, and part of their kind of bad faith move, I think, has been to actively try, since Thatcher and Reagan, to actively try to break down the post-war sort of social contract, which was this sense of unity that came out. It was fostered during the war years, and it also grew organically during the war years, just from the fact that people were meeting and working with and living and dying alongside people not of their own social class, of their own racial group, of whatever else. They were being exposed to each other in a way that we don't always get. And that created this sense of unity, which they literally are trying to tear apart. And one of the ways they're trying to do it is by making public services worse. They are actively trying to put pressure on the NHS, for example, so that when they say we need to sell it off, we as a country will go, you know what, something does need to be done.
Yeah.
And but that's a choice. It's not that the NHS is inherently
I can have truck with individuals who, for me, it's the difference between being self-employed and employed. You know, I've spent most of my life self-employed. I am now mostly employed, and I'm happy to pay more tax now that I'm employed. It's different when you're self-employed because you don't know what's around the next corner. Now that, from an individual basis, that is probably healthy that we have a variety of views, that things that seem to matter selfishly to different people. What you're talking about, which is the scary new thing, is the active destruction of the other. Yeah. It's the it's seeking to destroy, seeking to dismantle those things. And part of, you know, maybe part of what that comes from, you know, unions, for example, in the early days, unions were quite conservative in some ways in the early days, because the message was about, you know, fundamentally a union is about a bunch of people who are collectively getting together for their benefit.
Yeah, and they could be very, very corrosive to the rights of other people. And for example, racist, you'd get a lot of unions that were closed shops to black people, for example.
Yeah, yeah. And so that kind of flag flying, torch burning thing can go both ways.
It can.
It isn't necessarily a healthy
thing. But, you know, the thing is, like, I think, again, this is the part of the disenchantment, isn't it, that came out of the Reagan and Thatcher era, this disenchantment with unions and the attacks on their power. Because there have been unions that, you know, historically behaved really badly. I don't think any of us, I'm very left wing. I'm not going to stand up for the Teamsters in the 1960s because they were mafia ridden and corrupt up the wazoo. There's no question. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, unions have given us sick pay and holiday pay and the weekend, you know, and the concept of bank holidays, all incredible things that we take absolutely for granted came from union activism. And there are things like this that collective action can do. I know I sound like an activist. This is amazing. Collective action can do that individual action cannot. I mean, you know, and I know, for having been freelancers, freelance life and having to advocate for yourself all the time on every single point is very, very difficult. And you are, as an individual person working with large companies, you can often be at a real disadvantage.
Big time.
And things like unions are meant to kind of balance that up a bit.
No union for radio presenters. And I tell you that the other thing is that, you know, one of the things that I do now full time is to do with innovation and looking at the future of work. And that actually, in both cases, that like the company that I used to work for that you might be familiar with, certainly there was no union in there for the job that I did, and the business would have been better. Their business, their money would have increased if they'd had a mechanism to really listen to people on the front line.
Yeah.
And whether that's union or whether that's, and businesses are going to have to do this in the future because, and I suppose this is a positive, if you do dismantle people's rights and if you do make everybody essentially behave more like a gig economy within a gig economy, then where you actually get to is that you have no power over them in terms of saying, well, you won't have any progression in this job for the next 20 years if you don't do as I say, because they'll go, I don't expect it to be here longer than 6 months, so why should I? So if you want a workforce that will stick around, if you want a workforce that actually believe in what they're doing, you have to start looking at things like a genuine sense of well-being amongst staff, genuine innovation, progression, and not fake versions of it, because people are.
It's really hard for me to take a lot of companies seriously when they talk about this stuff, because
about fruit in reception.
The trade-off that they're proposing is essentially, you know, certainly in journalism, and okay, journalism is an industry in particularly bad shape in some respects right now. But what you're looking at is, okay, you're going to have a newsroom that's half the size or a third of the size that it used to be. We expect you to produce more, not less, because we're now keeping our website updated or our podcasts or our video spots or whatever else that particular organization is doing. So we expect far fewer of you to do far more for far less money, but it's okay because we have a therapist on call you can talk to when you get overwhelmed. And, you know, that is not actually, that is not something
work,
that,
Helen.
But this is it. It's not just bad for the newsroom. It's bad for the whole of society, because what you have is our whole generations getting burnt out. You have whole generations who will never be able to buy a house.
Yeah.
You have whole generations who can't afford to have kids and maintain a, you know, not just a sort of middle class lifestyle, but just like a safe lifestyle where they know they have enough income to look after that child. People are making very rational decisions. Yeah,
it's a shame.
It's horrific.
But just like with climate change, you know, essentially the the point with climate change is it's us that's going to get damaged. The planet's fine. Like, the planet will burn us all. It'll flood us all. We'll all disappear. And the planet will become something else. In terms of, like, is Mother Nature going to stop existing? No, we're going to stop existing if we don't stop pissing around. These middle generations... Go on.
Yeah, I mean, well, that approach, I hear that a lot as regards climate change, and again, that feels nihilistic to me a little bit, just because I know you don't mean it that way, but like, the thing is, right?
I'm trying to get a better position on my beanbag. Carry on.
Like, Earth will exist, but lots of what we think is beautiful about Earth won't exist.
Yeah,
lots of what we think is valuable about Earth won't exist, and you know, if aliens ever land on Earth, they'll be like, what the fuck did these wankers do? Like, maybe. And also there's the other nightmare scenario, which is, it's not going to be a clean sort of womb, whoosh, everybody's gone. It's going to be a slow, awful
decline
where millions of people maybe die at a time of, you know, storms and, you know, climate change and starvation and famine and disease. I mean, there's an argument that coronavirus is partly at least caused by climate change and partly at least caused by people who can't farm going and eating wild animals. This is, you know, this is real shit, and it's going to be like centuries of shitness that destroy our civilization, but they do not actually destroy us, and we're still there scrabbling out a living. We're just reduced to the Stone Age. This is not a cool scenario.
No, I don't think it is a cool scenario, the nihilistic thing. I'm just making a statement of fact.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah, I do know what you mean.
Which is to say, the drivers to save the planet need to be not about saving the planet. The message has been poorly communicated because, like with Jeremy Corbyn, we have to start from a starting point, just like the unit. So post-war, as you said before, essentially world wars happened. People came back and said, we've proportionally, those of us who work in the factories and earn very little and are in danger, we've died a lot more than the people who own the land. So we now demand something different. And that's where the welfare state and labor all came from. So, what was my point? Climate change.
We need something similar with climate.
But that is it's right, but it's also a selfish driver because all of us act selfishly. I've sat down with friends who say, I would happily pay more tax. I believe, and I say to them, then pay more tax. You can give the government money. You can donate money to the government. And of course, they don't want to give up their mortgage and their whole house, and they don't want to live in a kibbutz. Otherwise, they would be doing it. And we have to start from the point of view that it is selfishness, which is a huge driver, whether you've just come out of a world war or not. And so the message that's given to people can't ever be, do this in order to save a planet in 200 years. It needs to be, do this because your petrol costs less.
But it is true. Okay, I don't think selfishness is the only driver, because I'm a starry-eyed optimist, despite everything I'm saying right now.
No, it isn't the only driver.
But it is a driver. I 100% agree with that. It is a driver. And I do think you're right, that the message needs to be changed. But I think what people need to understand, and this is the thing that really freaks me out, is this is not 200 years. This is the next 50 years. This is us in retirement age having to deal with this shit. And genuinely, we are, you know, this whole idea of, oh, let's, you know, retire and go on cruises like our parents or our grandparents did. That is 100% not happening for people in young adulthood right now. That is not going to be what we face as things stand. We are going to face a really, really, really difficult world. We may face water wars where there is not enough fresh water to go around. And I know that seems impossible and far away in this country, but it is a real thing that is going to affect huge parts of the world. Those people are then going to be on the move, desperately looking for water, and other places are going to have to deal with more refugees. And as we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years, we're really bad at dealing with refugees. in huge numbers.
And I don't look forward to watching that happen.
No, exactly. Who wants to sit there and watch millions of people, you know, starve or die of thirst? So that's one factor. But it's also in our own interest as well, because we're looking at more floods, we're looking at more heat waves, we're looking at more extreme weather of all sorts. And it's going to be the poor, who traditionally include most retirees, who are going to be most hard hit. This is absolutely in our interest to do this. Never mind your kids, never mind your grandkids, which you should also mind.
You know, more people died from poverty this year than from, like in Britain, than from any other cause. I think that's a true fact. I was on a training course last week. If that's not exactly right, it's the point of the fact was poverty is the thing that we do not care about. It's the same as saying there's going to be water wars somewhere else. As long as we are not the ones experiencing it, and as long as it's not real for us, it's too easy to say, "Oh dear," and just
it is, and we and it's a bad impulse on our parts. But I think also we need to be reminded of this. You know, I think we need to be reminded that it's not, you know, the whole greed is good thing. I mean, that line, by the way, in Wall Street by Oliver Stone was meant as satire. And instead it's been adopted by entire generations as like their motto and their idea of cool. Like I think we've got to flip socially a little bit. I think we've got to be, this is a little bit back, getting back to the left wing taking the gloves off, but I think we've got to be more judgmental of bad behavior. I think we've all got to be a bit more like vegans are. And I don't say that lightly, because I don't actually want to be vegan, but I understand that they do have, they are right. I mean, global food production is a massive contributor to climate change. And if we all let vegan, it would be a much, much, much smaller contributor. I don't want to give up dairy. I don't have any plans to, but I feel like I should. And I'm beginning to feel like, at the very least, we should all be feeling more like that about everything. Like, people should be made to feel guilty about having unnecessarily insane cars. That should no longer
I don't think guilt works.
Young women should not sleep with guys who pull up in a flash car. Like, I'm just saying that right now. If you are an incredibly hot woman, that should be a massive turnoff for you. Like, just do not do that. You have the power to save the planet.
Yeah.
At least help.
But I don't think that works. I don't think guilt ever is a good driver.
I'm not saying guilt, but I actually do think it can be a good driver. I think it can change people's behavior.
No, you're 100% wrong. This is another example of fake news. No, I think,
look at mask wearing. There are people who have absolutely been guilted into mask wearing. 100%. I know them.
Have they been guilted into it, or are they just afraid of being looked
They're afraid
at
of being
like
pilloried, or they're afraid of being that's all the same.
I think that's true about. No, okay, you're
afraid,
right,
afraid of being judged, right. Let's say
you're right. If there is something like that, then guilt can work. But if there's something that people enjoy doing and you try and guilt them out of it, it almost always leaves them doubling down on how much they do.
Oh, sure. And
that is my problem with standing up to fake news accusations. This is the Box Set Pod on...
we did have a point.
Yeah, on Apple's TV, they've got that boys' Senate thing. You know, where they see all the boys who are running for... They go to, like, political camp.
Mm-hmm.
Seen that?
No, I haven't. Oh, I think I've heard about it. Yeah, it does ring a bell, but I haven't watched it yet.
So a load of boys are gotten together to Austin, I think it is, and it's like a political camp, and many presidents have gone to this thing.
Oh, yeah, it does ring a bell.
And it's all boys, and they debate things, and they are split into two teams, and they have to try and win an election, and they have to take a left wing right wing position.
Sure.
And it doesn't matter where they come from; they've got to assume the opposite argument.
Sure.
Which is nice, you know, good traditional debate club type situation. But in this documentary, what they follow is, I think what once would have been the traditional debate club activity, is it's really telling that even, you know, they're 16, 17 year olds. This one guy, I think he almost kind of wins the whole thing. And he's been making these incredibly anti-choice arguments, anti-abortion arguments. This is the shit that we shouldn't say. We shouldn't say anti-choice. We should say anti-women being able to make up their own minds. And he makes these arguments. And in his piece to Camera later, he goes, I am completely pro-choice. I was saying the things that I know would get everybody riled up, and that's what you learn about politics.
Yeah.
And it's literally seeing that mindset that you were talking about earlier, the Murdoch fueled mindset of it doesn't matter. Truth does not matter. And whatever I can do to get a win, whatever we can do to get another viewer.
But it's getting into that nihilism. It's getting into this sense that nothing matters, so I can just do whatever the fuck I want to win in this immediate moment. And I think that's really what, again, we have to kind of get past. I mean, you know, that's a kid, and I kind of know the kind of person who would do that. And they're going to, okay, here's the problem. We're treating real politics like it's a debate club. That's why we have, Boris Johnson in number 10 Downing Street. And that is a guy who has 100% all his life treated politics like a debate club. That is a guy who the night before deciding on Brexit, on whether to join the campaign, wrote two op-eds, didn't he? He wrote one pro-EU and one anti. And then he basically just used the one that, you know, he decided to go with. And he went, and you cannot tell me otherwise, he went with the Brexit campaign because he thought it would be better for his political career. He thought they'd lose for a start, which was foolish and a risk. Yeah. And he thought it would build his own personal base to challenge David Cameron for the Tory leadership.
Yeah.
That's 100%, and I will never be convinced otherwise because I'm sure of it from the people involved. That's not a guy who treats the actual real world consequences of his actions as being nearly as important as his own ambition. And that's what we have to move away from. Like, we have to start acting like there are consequences, because there are. Like, I mean, Trump didn't care. Trump also expected to lose. He was planning to launch Trump TV on the back of his campaign.
Yeah.
He was horrified when he won.
This has been
the best horrified
4 years of marketing for his Trump TV. It's talk about a platform.
Well, this is it. He and Melania was horrified. She didn't think, none of their inner circle thought they were going to win. And it was an unpleasant surprise. And it should never be that.
You had the courage of conviction. And the problem is that you don't find this funny. And I find hilarious.
I think things are funny and horrifying. This is the Tucker and Dale versus evil of real life politics.
Yeah.
I mean,
It is horrendous, but at the same time, what precursed this in Britain?
Mm.
I remember when Jamie and I did a show on BBC Six Music, and it was 2010, and we walked into the studio, and a very famous broadcaster, who certainly is a champagne lefty, was on air before us, and we walked into the studio, and he was about to hand over shows to us, and he was watching the TV in there, and he said the words, "That's the Labour Party out of business for 20 years." And he was looking at the screen, and it was when the vote had happened to pick Ed Miliband over David Miliband. And he was absolutely right. Ed Miliband, who, by the way, apparently does a great podcast, and like so many ex-politicians, shows how smart and erudite and great he can be now that he's not trying to be an actor. I watched Ed for those years, and I had no doubt whatsoever that he was not going to be voted in, because this is a huge. I think that entertainment should be taken seriously. That's my motto in life. Full stop. Which is why when we had the Fatima the Ballerina's next job might be in tech thing, I hate people who are entertainers or journalists or media people. I hate them being discredited or just being underestimated, because these things are crafts. They are difficult. They are not. They're things that are supposed to look easy. And most people, if they did, it would look like a tool.
Yeah.
Anyway, the point is, I hate the fact that I am not saying that what Trump and Boris have done, I don't respect what they've done, but I am saying that this, the prerequisite for who you have as a leader, needs to be first and foremost, but it needs to be equally as important that they've got content, but also they are the lead singer of the band and not the drummer. Don't pick the drummer. If Chris Martin wasn't the lead singer of Coldplay, they would not have sold any records, right? The drummer is not as good. And Labour just kept putting up the drummer. And it doesn't matter how brilliant they are. I think you would be a brilliant Prime Minister, Helen. I think I would be a brilliant Prime Minister. But based on maybe our accents or maybe the way we look or whatever, ultimately you still have to get a majority of people to vote for you who are your natural enemy. Or you need to at least aim for that. You need to think about that whilst also energising the people who would vote for you.
And I think that's one of the ways Corbyn...
And Boris was a shoo-in, because we were hungry for people were hungry for being able to say, finally, this person doesn't sound like they're lying to me, even if they are liars. So you get an old man on a stool in the middle of Texas in a bar who talks shit constantly can look at Trump and say, I know what that is. I know who that is. He talks shit just in the same way that I talk shit. What they're not getting is this vision of blandness that had come before. And the most upsetting thing for me is the PR control that came post Blair, and Blair was very good at looking into a camera and communicating with people.
He was.
But the control from that point on, if you look at Gordon Brown trying to talk, Ed Miliband trying to talk, Jeremy Corbyn trying to talk, it's just really poor communication skills. So what's left, what fills the vacuum, is people who don't give a fuck about what their communications people tell them, because they're such bumbling, their personalities, that we vote for personality.
I mean, no, I completely get the power of personality, but I just think we as voters, I guess, and certainly as just human beings on the earth, have got to start looking for something in addition. Like, I just, you know, I would 100%.
We have to pick the better person. We have to get involved with the parties.
Yeah.
And make sure that a person is selected, because to talk about box sets for one second, and I justify this podcast, by the way, and it all being about TV and the media, what's the series of unfortunate events?
Yep.
So Patrick, what's his name?
Neil Patrick Harris.
Neil Patrick Harris. Oh, if you've seen the Jim Carrey version, very similar
Jim
character.
Carrey, yeah.
I want you to imagine that you've got a vote. You've got a vote for who you would like to be Prime Minister. That character, Neil Patrick Harris or Jim Carrey, as that character versus... Count Olaf versus... just imagine...
Violet Beauregard.
Well, even Violet's a good character. I'm thinking about, you know, a traffic warden. Right? Your average traffic warden. There's no question that Count Olaf would win. It's not about whether or not people think he's evil or capable of doing evil. They're voting for somebody who they think they know who they are. Like,
yeah,
that's
I know this. Yeah. I know it. I'm very, very frustrated by it, but I do understand. I just think, you know, Boris has made an entire lifetime of lying about stuff and not caring that he's getting stuff wrong or that he's made stuff up, literally not caring. And I just, the disconnect there is really stunning to me.
Of course,
you know,
is.
Like The counter argument, by the way, to all this is like Joe Biden is not the most energizing figure in the Democratic Party.
No, but Joe.
But what Biden, you have there is a what you have there is a majority of the American people, a 5 million or 6 million strong majority of the American people, going, I just want to be able to not pay attention to his tweets again.
I mean, it's the one example we kept thinking in the last couple of elections in Britain that we were going to get a protest vote, and actually what we found out was it was the exact opposite. But the and so I really thought that Trump was going to win this latest one.
I didn't, but I worried because the potential was there.
I was just so used to the disappointment that I thought we were going to get another one. But when you look at it and you go, so in order for Biden to scrape it, in order to actually win a an anti-vote, you have to actually be going through a pandemic where millions of people are catching a flipping flu. Like, that's how bad it has to be. And that's how important it is that you have to put up the lead singer, put somebody up. Because
but you also have to persuade people.
He's a liar. When you say Boris appears to be, of course, I'm looking at Boris, and in my heart of hearts, I can tell you that whilst I would never have voted for Boris because I understand politics beneath that, I totally get why everybody voted for Boris because
he's been on Have I Got News For You, and he's funny, and he's,
I am a liar. We are all liars. We're all flawed. I'm saying whether you pick the hero or the villain, pick a character that people believe is real.
But here's my thing with that. Okay. So first of all, I feel like we as a society, again, and I see this in obviously movie journalism, have become too fucking fixated on villains. We are obsessed with giving the villains a motivation, a sympathetic ear. So they're not just bad. They've got a point, guys. I mean, the Thanos kind of situation. And at some point, no, they're just bad guys. He literally just killed half the universe. He doesn't get points for his motivation. None whatsoever.
Yeah.
Dust the bastard. I don't care, right?
Yeah.
So first of all, I feel like we are coming from understandable sympathy, commendable even sympathy, and an attempt to understand our enemies. We are giving our enemies too much credit because ultimately their motivations don't matter if what they do is evil, right? So that's my kind of...
do when the other balance for me is going, don't... I had a brilliant interview with Jon Stewart who was explaining the... You probably did when he was released Irresponsible.
I haven't heard it.
It summed up very quickly. I think we've got 3 minutes here. Summed up very quickly. The if you go to watch a concert and it's a genre concert, if you go to a country gig or a techno gig or a jazz gig, you know the audience, you know what they want, and you know how to please them. That is the right wing. Tends to be very similar-minded people who have a certain set of values, and it's very easy to communicate there.
And the other thing, of course, is the right wing is more authoritarian, so they're more likely to, even if they disagree with each other, go along with it.
So get behind the leader, no matter who it is. On the left, you have a vast array of people that range from champagne socialists, probably like me, right the way down to activist groups of all kinds, and activist groups that disagree with each other.
Massively,
and union groups that disagree with each other. And the unions disagree with the activists. And the champagne socialists are hated by all of them, but they're the ones that get elected. And so the left is this... not a genre concert. It's this huge random selection. It's like trying to please everybody in an airport at one time with one choice of song. It's really difficult. Now, one of the lies that are being spun, that method of sticking to this narrative of like fake news or whatever the agenda is, whatever the bullshit is, it wears us down. It makes us feel exhausted, those who believe in actual balance or truth or whatever. And Jon Stewart's kind of point was, don't let it get you down. Be vocal and take things on and look to change the systems. Don't look to challenge. So if I see a YouTube video that's got 300 comments on it that are all slagging a journalist off, for example, in that situation, I don't write a comment on there at the moment. And I'm of two minds. Should I get involved there? Or am I just joining their party? Or, like, ultimately, if I comment under a video by some idiot, am I
almost giving
in the mind of another commenter? Or am I actually adding a click, standing am I going to the concert by doing that? Is it better to ignore them?
I mean, I think individually, one by one, it's not. It's interesting. I've always had this policy, if you like, of engagement with trolls to an extent. I've become a little bit heavier on the ban button with a couple of groups. But my general approach has been, even if somebody comes and says something mean, to actually argue it out with them. And I'm not necessarily polite or kind when I argue it, if I think they're in bad faith, but I will argue it out. And most of the time, those people don't come back because they can't actually argue the points one-on-one.
Yeah.
Now, I'm lucky that I'm in, you know, a sort of a small enough corner of the internet that they do come usually one by one and not hundreds at a time. I'm not saying that this works for everybody who is the victim of Twitter mobs or any other kind of online harassment. But sometimes one-on-one, I think you can a little bit get through to people and a little bit encourage them to, at the very least, reconsider their arguments to make better arguments.
Yeah.
Which they usually can't do. So I think I was telling you just before we hit record, at one point I got in an argument with a bunch of men's rights activists online who believe that, you know, we do live in a sexist society, but it's men who are the real victims here. And look, just to be clear, like the patriarchy has horrific results for men. Like it, you know, means men can't necessarily feel comfortable expressing their feelings. It means they don't necessarily have the freedom to express themselves.
Suicide.
However they want without being... Exactly. Yeah. There are real, real issues that the men face as a result of the patriarchy. But to suggest that therefore it's women's fault only or principally, I don't think is fair, because I think everybody has to dismantle the patriarchy and together and be more equal. And then maybe we'll see things improve in those respects, as well as in terms of, you know, rape and you know, abortion, all the things, all the problems that women face as well. Anyway, the point is, all of these guys, and there were tens of, if not hundreds of them, coming at me to argue over the course of about a week after I got drawn into this. They only had like three different examples of, you know, really killer arguments they thought would really destroy my point of view. Like one of them was in World War One, some women gave some men white feathers and shamed them into going off to die. In World War One, right? Now, never mind that that was 100 years ago. Never mind that the white feather movement was started by a man. Never mind that that was not exactly the only thing pressuring men to go off to war. Never mind that the war was started by men. It was women's fault.
Yes.
According to these men, all because of these white feathers that were handed out.
Yeah.
But like, when you have tens of guys coming to you with this argument that men are the real victims here because of the white feathers 100 years ago. I mean, that's a weak argument. If that's all you got, guys, come on. You've got to see that there are other things happening. So in that case, I did have to block a bunch of people because it was just unrelenting and I got bored.
Yeah.
But a few of those people at least engaged enough to go away and stop on of their own accord. Because, you know, you've got to see that your argument is not that strong. And I think that's, if you can have one-on-one conversations, then you can sometimes get through to people. But I think the really important thing to do is, well, one thing is to kind of get some media awareness, read around. Don't just trust, what is it, the OAN that a lot of people are using in the States, or Fox, or The Sun, or The Mail, or whoever it is that you read. Like, read more widely. Because you will find a very, very different picture. And that's not because the journalists are, you know, kowtowing to their big moneyed bosses. It's sometimes because they know what the facts are, guys.
This is, I am so livid about this point that I am so protective over journalists that there is a divide between, there are some scum arsehole journalists who, you know, traditionally work for newspapers and red tops, that essentially journalists who are broadcasters and journalists who work for Empire magazine and people like that, they're under much greater rules. They are trained, they are seeking balance, and they're good people, and they try and be fair, and they live under far greater scrutiny than anybody in their normal job would live under. Imagine doing your normal job and every sentence you said to somebody that day was questionable, was questioned, or able to be questioned, or able to be a lie or fake or late or early, whatever. It would be horrendous for you. And without, at the moment, there seems to be the internet is saying journalists are fake, fake news, bring them down. The mainstream media is a disgrace. I mean, let's live in a world now where we do that, where we remove the mainstream media. What are we left with there? How do you find out about a pandemic that's coming around the corner? How do you find out? How do you have somebody asking a politician if they really did steal this money or embezzle this money? You literally have no connection to the world other than what? Are you going to reintroduce town criers? Like, is that how you're going to communicate things, or is that the level
this is
of
it. People investigation? People are replacing the quote unquote mainstream media with these very, just dodgy sources. They're just, you know, it's a weird disconnect to me that you're going to be so suspicious of the mainstream media. You're going to cut them off from your life because you can't trust them, but you're going to trust some dude with a Facebook page.
Yeah.
I don't get that thinking. I really don't. And I understand intellectually what their argument is, oh, well, he's, you know, unconnected. He's beholden to no one. Therefore he can tell us the truth. But what reason does he have to tell you the truth that you can trust?
And I think that there is a problem about protagonism. Let's say protagonism is a word, right? We are fundamentally good people. People are good, I believe. They are also bad, but they are good. And we believe somebody, we take things at face value when people say things. So, and what we do with a protagonist is when we watch a film, we imagine that we are the lead character, which is why it's important not just to have white men as the lead character of everything, etc. However, that's what we do. And a good protagonist, it doesn't matter who the lead character is. We all are so universal and we're so behind them that it's awesome and those films are great. Now, what we do with Trump, Boris, the guy on the internet who says something, somebody who says, don't worry, climate change isn't happening, is we do the same thing. We see something intimately and we imagine that they are us. So when Dominic Cummings gets sacked finally, people are in tears. Some people will be in tears because they'll be saying this is cancel culture, it's disgraceful. What they're really doing is imagining that they are Dominic Cummings and saying he's a human being and this hurts. Yeah. I shouldn't have gotten rid of.
This is a point I was going to make earlier and then I forgot what I was saying by the time I'd got to the bit about Thanos. But absolutely, that's exactly what I was going to say earlier. So this is actually something I've written about a little bit in my book, which is coming out in February. It's called Women versus Hollywood, The Fall and Rise of Women in Film. So it's basically a film history looking past, typical, present, and future. I know, right?
Jesus.
But it's just looking at men
worked in Hollywood as well.
What about men, eh? Eh? Well, you'll be glad to know. I went through the index yesterday and there's huge numbers of male names in there. Okay. But
as long as there's a majority, it's fine. Carry on.
Yeah, for sure. But this is the thing, right? So there were women at the sort of early dawn of Hollywood, the silent era. There were women who were directing and producing and editing all sorts of jobs. But as Hollywood became more professional and more of an industry, women were forced out because that was not compatible with the day. You couldn't have a woman in a position of power. It just made you look weird, you know? And then it's literally only in the last 20, 30 years that women have really begun in any kind of numbers to work their way back in. And they still make up no more than about 12% of feature directors of major Hollywood pictures, despite being about 50% of people going into film school, and they have been for 20 or 30 years. Anyway, so that's all kind of happening behind the scenes. But my point here was about exactly what you were just saying.
Protagonism.
What were you just saying?
Protagonism.
This tendency we have to... No, it was after that. What did you say after that?
That we are putting ourselves in their position. So Dominic Cummings whatever.
Oh, yes. Okay, right. So when I got to the chapter about sort of Me Too and stuff like that.
Yes.
What you run into and what you find a lot was... Let's say with Mel Gibson, right?
Yeah.
Who is a very popular guy historically in Hollywood.
He's
well liked by his fellow castmates, his crew, his directors, everybody else.
Yeah.
And then, of course,
Mel Gibson
happened.
Yeah.
Mel Gibson happened. And what you have is a lot of people lining up to give him a second chance. Right. So you had a lot of people in when he was hired briefly for, I think it was The Hangover Part 2, I think he was going to be in.
Right.
He was actually hired, and then there was basically a revolt from the cast and crew who went to the studio and said, no. right. essentially. This is well documented. This is not coming from me.
Yeah.
And you had some people who were very uncomfortable with that in the cast and crew, because they were sort of saying, essentially, you know, where he goes, so might we. And it is this tendency that we all have to acknowledge our own faults and say, well, yes, I've lied too. I've been hypocritical too. Maybe I've sometimes had a racist thought too. I've sometimes had a homophobic thought too. I have been unkind to a whole other group of people only in the privacy of my own head, but I have done it.
Times that I had drunk driven and had a massive verbal bender about the Jews. I more times than I've had hot dinners, Helen.
But there is this tendency to give each other the benefit of the doubt, and it is a commendable yes. and a good tendency.
Yeah.
And we feel like we would be hypocritical to judge him for what he said when he was drunk, because we know we said that unkind thing about Karen that one time we were drunk or whatever, you know?
Fucking hate Karen.
But at the same time, at some point, hypocrisy is the lesser evil, right? And we can say, I know I have... Let's say you're not a great person, and let's say you say to yourself, look, I have cheated on my spouse, and I have gotten divorced, and I have slept with a porn star, and I have, you know, gotten into, I've failed to pay my bills, and I have been bankrupt a bunch of times, and therefore I forgive all these things in Trump because it would be hypocritical not to. The lesser evil in that sense is to be hypocritical and say, I'm still going to judge Trump as unfit for office. It is the lesser evil to say, I have lied, but I'm still going to judge Boris Johnson for lying because you shouldn't do it when you're prime minister. That is the lesser evil. And I think we all have to be maybe a little bit more judgmental, a little bit more hypocritical, and a little bit more less tolerant of other people's flaws, because they're taking advantage of us. They're taking advantage.
But then are you becoming the monster that you're trying to slay?
I don't know that we are, actually, as long as it's the lesser evil.
Mm.
I just don't think, you know, I think if you're running for public office, or if you're trying to pick up million-dollar paychecks for starring in a film, it's okay to hold you to a slightly higher standard.
Yeah. I blame marketing departments. You know, it's like how to... It's not even... Sorry, people with marketing departments. I don't mean that. I mean, there is no place for nuance.
Mm.
But there has to be a place for nuance in some way, shape, or form. Or at least you don't have to be nuanced to have rules. You can say, for example, let's say there's a celebrity who enters a court case and loses that court case. And then as a studio, you fire that person. That's perfectly fine. If those are your rules, do it. But I kind of want to see the rules. Like, I believe it would help everybody if you said, here's what we're doing, and here is why we're doing it, and here's the logic that backs that up. And I think
in studio cases, for example, a lot of the time, those kind of employment contracts will have some kind of morality clause. Now, not every piece of behavior will be spelled out, but there will be a general morality clause in many, many contracts of that sort. I don't know about obviously any specific ones because we're talking hypothetically, but that's a thing that exists in the world.
But I don't think that's communicated to us. I don't think, I think that I mean, the line of...
I feel like we're pretty clear on that. Do you not? I mean, I just feel like if you heard that, you know, celebrity X, you know, stole a car and was then let go from their unrelated to cards job, you'd be like, yeah, I kind of see why they had to do that.
I don't think
that's...
If it was unrelated to cars, like if they'd been arrested, let's say somebody had been, well, let's go the full hog, someone committed a murder and they went to prison for 30 years.
Okay,
when they left prison, i.e. served their time,
that's a different
should
thing.
They be allowed a job as an actor?
But that's a different thing. That's a very different thing from, say, Mel Gibson. It's a very different thing from your hypothetical with an actor who loses a court case. It's that is a case where somebody, not to be a cliche, but like did the time.
They have done the time, though, haven't they?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
In my example, they've done the time as well.
That's a different thing. So that person, there's no more question of that.
Deserves a job.
It may well be that the victim's family speaks out. It may well be that huge numbers of people agree with the victim's family, and it may well be that the person trying to give that celebrity that job actually turns around and goes, you know what, this was a bad idea, it's gonna cost us in terms of goodwill and, you know, money, publicity and everything else, and they might turn around and think it and change their minds. But, you know, that those are the kind of commercial decisions that we allow to happen. I don't know how you get around that.
Well, if there's a question over somebody's head, for example, when Harvey Weinstein is on trial or whatever, and there's a question over the head and they are in line for court, then yes, I get it. No work. But when society is, when justice has been ruled, for me, that's the point at which, like, if somebody isn't a danger to the people on that set, if they're not a danger to society, in other words, if they are not serving a sentence.
I think the point is, right, in that hypothetical, like, first of all, I don't have any problem with a person who has come out of prison getting a job. Like, I think we should absolutely be supporting people back into work, because otherwise you just end up with more people in prison. Like, it's a bad idea. But if you're talking about like a celebrity being offered an incredibly well-paid, presumably, job after serving a prison sentence for something as heinous as murder, which is our hypothetical, I think I would understand there being a potential reputational cost for that. That is not someone who is trying to, you know, support themselves. That is somebody who is trying to kind of play the system, maybe to an extent. And the problem is, you don't have a right to other people's good opinion of you. You don't, and you have to deal with that.
No, that's like, true. That's
normal true. Normal people have to deal with that every day, you know?
If people don't buy, if the box office doesn't work, the box office doesn't work. So I also get that, you know, commercial organization, it's their choice. Like, go with
their choice is going to be commercial, yeah.
But for me, morally speaking, I start from the point of view that, I don't start from the point of view that we live in a world where actors are perfect human beings.
And, no, of course
that's
not.
That's where the problem begins. Is that
but they don't have to be, nobody's saying perfect. Like but we forgive a huge array of behavior in the idols that we have and we love. We forgive a lot, actually.
Doesn't happen in music very much. Musicians can get away with anything. Film stars, nope.
A bit like, well, I mean, there's been quite a lot of stories. I mean, okay, this is mostly stuff that was covered up, but you know, Clark Gable was involved in a fatal hit and run. And that was covered up by the studio. So was, I think, John Huston.
This was covered up.
That was covered. No, that's a different thing. I know.
Essentially, like, do heroin, hang out of a tree, and then crash a car, and then just go on stage, and that's fine.
I know. Look, there are celebrities working today who have been involved in fatal car crashes.
Yeah.
And who are, that was documented, and that was, you know, known at the time.
For a long time, though, didn't they? I think.
The one I'm thinking of, it was back in the 80s, and
does their name begin with an M?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that person disappeared. Certainly didn't do as well as you would have expected.
No, but then you've got things like the, I don't know how much I want to say about this on air.
Do you know what? We have to stop. I am 20 minutes late for someone who's waiting for me, and I'm too addicted to this conversation. Do you want to do it again if we can in the next
week? Sure, let's do it.
So we'll do a part two, because Helen is going to do a podcast of her own leading up to Christmas about Christmas films. So we should talk about that as well.
Yes.
But I also think that Helen is so multifaceted and lucidly expressive about the issues of politics and media combined that I thought this might be an interesting thing. If anyone's made it to the end of this podcast, congratulations.
Yeah, I'm so sorry for all the
win a pot of gold. You've been interested. Thanks, Helen.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
Speak to you soon. Thanks for listening to the Box Set Pod. Bye.